Good evening, everybody. My name is David Kingsley. I'm a governor of the school, but I'm much more importantly the president of our environmental network here, which is quite a strong one and has many alumni who are members who are very active in the environmental movement, as you'll probably know. It's an interesting fact that LSE, when it started, its first few courses included transport in the form of railway economics. It's a sad fact that we don't have a group of people concentrating on aviation economics here at this point in time. And yet it's always been a thread which has run through the school's history. But we're very fortunate tonight because at least those of us that are sitting here, and we'll be able to go out and spread the word afterwards, are going to hear from some I think, real experts. So there are a couple of them describe themselves as sort of enthusiastic amateurs, but don't you believe it. And we're going to look at what the scene is at the moment in terms of the way airports and development of airports is being handled in this country. And we've got in order across the table, so you know who they are. Right on the left is Peter Mackenzie Williams. He heads up the aviation part of the Transport Research Lab, and he's going to draw, as it were, from what has recently come out on the future of airports and aviation in this country, white paper, and he has some very interesting critiques of it, which I think we'll find very, very helpful. Then next we have John Stewart, and John actually described himself as an economist of sorts, was that right?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Anyway.
Anyway,
John is a real live activist who has been very active through an organization called Airport Watch and through the Heathrow local movement, and he wants to look at areas of managing growth, and he will explain why he thinks it's necessary to talk about that, because it isn't being very well managed at the moment. And then third we have Gareth Harper. Now, Gareth has been again looking at what the proposals of the government are, and is going to tell us whether he thinks that they're getting their facts right. It's very impressive when these papers come out and the statements come out. They look like the truth. We're going to have a little underneath that tonight. And lastly, we have Hannah Ellis, who also is keeping an eye on what's happening in the aviation world, but particularly across Europe, and particularly in relation to how this is being financed and how much environmental factors are being taken into account. Right, so off we go with Peter. Peter Mackenzie Williams, thank you.
Thank you. Is there a mouse or?
I think it's up there.
Got it. Right. No worries. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here this evening. I have to say when.
But can I just check, is the sound good? Right. I think pull the mics, as I said earlier. I think you do need to have your mics very loud.
When I was an Equinox graduate myself, the LSE was but a dream. It was beyond, I fear, the capacity of my A levels. We all aspired to the LSE in those days, not only for its academic achievements, but because of its extracurricular activities like lobbing bricks at policemen, which all seemed very popular at the time with many of us. In those days, I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think there probably wasn't an environmental management school here. In fact, there probably wasn't anywhere, possibly with the exception of Berkeley. So that certainly is a sign of great progress. I'm speaking this evening very much as a commentator on the numbers which have gone around the recent lead up to the white paper which was released in December on the future aviation policy for the UK. I'm giving a bit of a global context to that. I'm looking at the Department for Transport forecasting process, which was used in the preparation of the white paper. I'm looking to some degree specifically at the Southeast, but also at what the white paper had to offer for the country as a whole. I've got a raft here of slides which I'm going to try to get through very quickly, but essentially this first one is dealing with GDP growth in recent years. Air traffic forecasting has tended over the last couple of decades to rely on the mantra that you take GDP and add 2%, and that's probably about right. These days people lean more towards saying that it's not quite that simple, but I think the conclusion I draw is that it's not that simple, in that they don't quite know how much to add to GDP, but it's certainly a case of adding to it rather than subtracting. Traffic growth through the 90s here. For those of you not familiar, RTK is revenue ton kilometres and ATK is available ton kilometres. So the RTKs are what you're actually carrying and the ATKs are what you're offering in the way of supply. And it's interesting to see that through most years in the 90s, the growth of RTKs exceeded the growth in ATKs, which meant basically that the use of the capacity was becoming more efficient. 2001 obviously dipped in a big way. 2002 is quite an interesting one, because it shows that whilst traffic grew, the airlines were still taking the opportunity to trim capacity. Annual average growth globally for international services, IATA forecast at 4.7% annual compound. International Air Transport Association, it's the international body which represents airlines. IATA's forecasting process, when asked, they say, well, it's sort of Delphi plus. They ask airlines what their growth expectations are. They also ask regulators and the aircraft manufacturers, and it is absolutely certain that the manufacturers, and I would have thought most regulators, are using reasonably sophisticated econometric models to do their forecasting. So although IATA aren't forecasting in a particularly sophisticated fashion, I think the information they're drawing on is so derived. What I should have said right at the beginning is that these forecasts are all for unconstrained demand. This is basically assuming no demand management, no fuel taxes, no other sorts of pricing mechanisms, no reductions in capacity. These really simply show that 2001 to 2003 was a hiccup, but by 2006 the expectation is that things will be back to slightly more than had been expected for 2004. The next one really is just showing some regional variations. Southeast Asia, the strongest growth, as you might expect. Within key markets, the UK is expected to be one of the stronger growing. Germany, I think, is probably showing quite strongly here because of the continuing economic growth effects from unification. and this one is a little bit out of date now, but it does show, it's quite interesting in that it shows that the recovery from effectively the September 11 events was expected, and I think these figures were borne out, was expected to be stronger, quicker in within Europe than in a number of other key international markets. And looking at that in regional detail, 3.5 to 6.5% annual compound growth is the expectation, with these are routes from the UK, and perhaps not surprisingly, Eastern Europe is the one that's expected to grow most strongly because of the effect of the accession states. That's the IATA view. If we now move on to the UK government view, the figures here were used, were originally produced, apart from the 2002 actuals, were originally produced in, published in 2000, and they were taken forward and used in the consultation process for the white paper. And they show that from a 2002 actual level of about 190 million passengers, growth nationally is expected to go to between 500 and 600 million passengers by 2030, and to between 306 and 366 in the southeast. If we look in a little more detail at how the department arrived at its figures, this is where the gremlins start to come out of the woodwork. The domestic market is regarded as being a fairly mature one. That seems to be logical enough. Where the department, in my view, came rather unstuck was in its treatment of the low-cost scheduled market. That's the EasyJets and the Ryanairs of the world, whose adverts you can hardly have avoided seeing. Low-cost scheduled carriers only really came to us in around about the mid-90s. Their growth from nothing has been extremely rapid. The department, I think, was really at a bit of a loss because none of its traditional econometric modelling techniques really seemed to fit the low-cost model. It just grew far too quickly. The problem, of course, was that because it had been going for a relatively short time, there wasn't the time series of data which econometrics would normally demand. So they waved their fingers in the air, one surmises, and came to the conclusion that growth would continue to be rapid up until 2005, whereupon it would suddenly fall off the end of the plateau and go down to less than domestic. Which was a conclusion which really, I think, surprised a lot of people because it just seemed so intuitively unlikely. My view, this is my view, or this is the TRL view, I suppose, is that there did appear to be significant errors in the initial base calculations which the department used, because although it appeared to be using econometrics, it also, in its consultation paper, referred to a rather more back-of-the-envelope type of approach, and what it had done was take the compound growth over the previous two decades, split down by the two decades, and projected forward what it thought was most likely over the decade 2010. The problem which it encountered was that of the low-cost carriers, And it chose to pull them out of the overall growth figures and treat them as a separate case. And in so doing, it arrived at the conclusion that the average annual growth through the 90s was 4.3%, whereas in fact it had been just over 5. And I think really that was the sand on which much of its forecasting fell. The forecast for low-cost traffic I've really already dealt with. The department also appeared to underestimate the generative effect of the reduction in airfares, largely due to low-cost carriers. It acknowledges itself, and I'm going to show you a slide to demonstrate this in a moment, it acknowledges itself that its past forecasts have always tended to be undershoots, and that in itself suggests that its high growth forecasts are more likely to be the outcome. It appeared to us that it did not take adequate notice of the way in which regional demand can grow when new air services come on stream. And it also appeared that its, I'll show you another slide on this in a moment, its views on the growth in propensity to fly appeared pretty low. And we took a comparison with the way that propensity to fly had grown in the US in states which could be regarded as reasonably comparable with the UK. Now, this is the one that really draws out the past performance of the forecasts. If we start with the top line, as recently as 1994, the department was saying that the 2000 traffic level was going to be 150 million passengers nationally, whereas the outturn was 181. In 1994, it was forecasting that passengers in 2010 would have reached 232 million, whereas that figure was ratcheted up in both the forecasts which it produced in 97 and again in 2000. So there does seem to be a fairly consistent picture of revising forecasts upwards, really over quite short periods of time, only 3-year gaps between these forecasts. As far as propensity to fly is concerned, I apologise for the slightly confusing layout of this, but it really wasn't possible to do it any other way within the scaling. Over the period 96 to 2001, average annual growth in propensity to fly was 8.3%. The department's forecasts suggest that that's going to slow right down to 3.2%. During the period 2005 to 2030, and while one wouldn't suggest that they were likely to continue at the same growth rate, certainly somewhere in between seems, again, intuitively more likely in unconstrained demand, don't forget. This slide is almost a little bit of a non sequitur, but I thought it was quite interesting to throw it in because it does demonstrate quite clearly, I think, that the three main airports in the southeast serve very distinctly different markets. Heathrow is very much a traditional scheduled airport with a lot of transfer traffic between flights. Gatwick is about 50% traditional scheduled. These figures are for 2001. At that time, it had quite a low-cost segment, but I suspect that's grown a fair bit by now. And Stansted at that time was already very predominantly low cost only. If we look now quickly at the estimated capacities of the three main London airports with and without the new capacity which was being talked about in the consultation process. Heathrow's current capacity, they put as 61 million, notwithstanding the fact that it's already achieved about 65. They said that if you didn't do anything at all at Heathrow, but just let it grow to its absolute level of unbearability, then you'd get it up to 86. But the new runway proposed on the north side of the airport would take capacity on up to 128 million passengers. And similar figures, you don't need me to read them out in relation to Stansted and Gatwick. The process which was used to evaluate the various different proposals and very, very many permutations of choices between airports were considered. Don't think that this was the sort of level of consideration. For Heathrow, I think there were probably something like 20 different options that were examined of slightly differing positions and situations. But the general approach was to look at the amount of traffic growth that we facilitated and then to look at a number of different issues, including employment, noise, emissions, land take, numbers of properties that would have to be demolished, that kind of thing. And I've pulled out, purely for illustrative purposes, and not in order to try to demonstrate any particular picture, the comparisons for the three main airports between employee numbers and the numbers of population exposed to excess levels of nitrogen dioxide, which in the case of Heathrow, the NOx exposure is already fairly significant and more than doubles with the new runway. In the case of Gatwick, the emissions problem is far less, although it does go up somewhat with the new runway. But even with the new runway, it's lower than Heathrow at present. And excuse me, in the case of Stansted, really the emissions problem barely registered on the scale. And that is interesting, I think, because if we go on to look at what was recommended in the white paper, the government came out very firmly in recommending that, as a matter almost of indecent urgency, it wanted BAA, the operators of Heathrow, Gatwick and Stansted, to come forward with proposals for a second runway at Stansted, which it said it expected or it hoped or it thought could be in operation by around 2011-2012. Given that Heathrow Terminal 5 took from 1991, when the BAA board first approved it, to 2002 to get planning permission before anything could start being built, I can't help thinking this timetable is a bit on the optimistic side. After Stansted, they said that Heathrow should get a third runway sometime in the period 2015 to 2020, provided that environmental targets for the reduction in the exposure to NOx could be met. It made it clear that Heathrow was probably actually the first choice, but that because of the environmental exposure, Stansted should go first. So that, I think, is in itself quite interesting, because it does appear to me that the government on this occasion did put environmental considerations before the considerations of the aviation industry, which had made it very plain that Heathrow was the preferred option. Gatwick is kind of being held in first reserve. If Heathrow can't meet the environmental targets, then the government view was that Gatwick had a good case in its own right, I think it were the words. So that remains a possibility sometime in the period after 2020, by which time the current legal agreement not to build before 2019 expires. And as far as the rest of the country is concerned, Birmingham has been told that it can go for a second runway, Edinburgh somewhat later. Importantly, the white paper did not bring forward any proposals for any new airports, so that seemed to kick into touch the proposal to build at Cliff on the Kent side of the Thames estuary, and there were one or two other proposals, like a very large airport in the vicinity of Rugby, which also fell by the wayside. So very briefly, I just want to finish by giving you what I think is probably the most graphic illustration of how caution should be applied to the department's forecasts, specifically in respect to the low-cost sector. In the 2000 forecasts they produced, their high growth scenario was that the low-cost sector would reach 32 million passengers by 2020. The actual outturn for 2002 exceeded that. And sorry, can't keep up with these bullets. The latest rerun of their forecasting model, which appears almost in very small print, but certainly tucked away in the back of an annex, right at the back of the white paper, says that they now expect the low-cost sector to reach 103 million passengers by 2030. They don't give a 2020 figure, so we can't make a direct comparison, but clearly this is a very, very significant change from the forecast produced only in the year 2000. However, they don't appear to be saying that the overall figure will change as a result of this, the total market figure, from which one can only conclude that they think that all of the growth in low cost is going to come from traditional operators. And really, I'm sorry, I just can't buy that. In summary, I think economic trends point to continuing growth in demand. The DfT say up to 600 million. I would tend to lean to a figure greater than that in unconstrained demand. I hope I've demonstrated to you that there are worries about the DfT forecasting work. But the worries, I have to say, are all that they've underestimated. I really don't see it going the other way. The white paper has provided a number of clear indications of policy support for selected airport expansion. It has made it clear that there shall be no new airports within the policy period, which is, I think, welcome news in terms of reducing uncertainty. I'm sure there are those who would say that they would rather have certainty that nothing was going to be built at either Heathrow, Gatwick or Stansted, but there is now, I think, a framework of far greater certainty than has existed in the period since the 1985 white paper was released, and that I guess is something that is an advance.
Peter, thank you very much. Well, you've certainly shown the hazards of forecasting and the fact that they always seem to be underestimates when you don't want them to be. And I think that's set the basis now for John Stewart, who's going to look at, well, what do you do about this? He has some interesting thoughts on this. Over to you, John.
Thanks very much. If you can't hear me or I'm too loud, just put your hands up. If I go on too long, just offer to buy me a drink and I'll stop straight away. I chair Heycan Clear Skies, which represents the residents under the Heathrow flight path. I also chair Airport Watch, and I just want to say a word or two about Airport Watch before I go into the bulk of my presentation. Airport Watch was formed about 2 years ago, just as the consultation for the White Paper was emerging, and it brought together, and indeed brings together, the protest groups around from airports around the country, together with the national green NGOs like Friends of the Earth, Transport 2000, and so on. And the whole purpose of Airport Watch was twofold, and they're related. One is to ensure the government could not divide and rule. Because what we've seen in the past, I think, is local protest groups around airports saying, we don't want expansion here, but look over there, those green fields, they look lovely, put it somewhere else. And I think Airport Watch has succeeded in ensuring that that has not happened. And the related point is that only once you're actually not saying put it somewhere else, can you start to make the arguments against the growth in airport expansion. And it's those arguments I want to develop tonight. Because Airport Watch and I too believe that we do need to manage growth. Or more accurately, and I'll say more about this in a minute, we need to stop artificially stimulating growth. I'm also going to say a little bit later on that I think perhaps that's not radical enough, that maybe the government needs to look over the next 30 years for policies to reduce growth. But I'll come to that in a second. First of all, what are the reasons to at least manage growth, possibly reduce growth? I think they're twofold. One is the large environmental reasons, essentially climate change. At the moment, the aviation industry is right to say that aviation emits and contributes about 3.5% of all the man-made emissions that contribute to global warming. There is dispute in the research as to how much that will grow, but it could grow up to about 15% by the year 2050. What's not in dispute is that aviation is the fastest growing sector and contributor to global warming. And it's interesting that the government's white paper and the Royal Society for Prevention of, I was going to say for Prevention of Birds, no, if you remember, don't tell them. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the RSPB, is currently doing some research. And what it's beginning to show is that all the emission savings that the government it will achieve in the next 30 years from its policy of going towards renewable energy will be eaten up by the sort of expansion that the White Paper is talking about. So there seem to me to be very strong global warming reasons, very strong climate change reasons for managing growth, I would say in the Western world, for reducing growth. And the reason for that is this, I think I would suggest, and we may want to debate this later, there's a global equity issue here. The countries in the developing world are expanding their airports. China, for example, I believe is building 100 new airports over the next 10 years. They clearly don't have Terminal 5 inquiries there, but you never know that they may. But now, there are real questions, I know, whether people think that's the right sort model of development for a developing world. But I think, put that aside for a second, my point is that if that sort of expansion is taking place, it seems to me there's at least an argument in equity terms, in global equity terms, for saying that the Western world should actually not just manage growth, but reduce growth and reduce its contribution to climate change. The second reason why I think growth needs to be managed or possibly reduced is the local effects of aviation. There's the local air pollution and I think particularly the local noise. At an airport like Heathrow and some others as well, people are living with a flight coming over their homes one every 90 seconds. And it's widely accepted that if we've got the sort of growth the White Paper envisages, there will be more noise. There is not going to be the step change in technology we've seen that's produced quieter planes over the last 30 years in the next 30 years. So any small technological improvements there will be, with the sort of demand that Peter has very accurately outlined, that the white paper is predicting, will offset any technological improvements to reduce the noise of planes. There will be more noise. There may be more planes than one every 90 seconds coming over people's homes. And I think I would argue here that we shouldn't just be framing this debate in terms of just environment or the economy. We should be going outside that framework. We should certainly be going outside the framework that the government used in formulating the white paper. And we should be looking at the human rights and the moral aspects of this. I would ask you to consider, and perhaps this will also come up in discussion, whether it's actually morally and ethically acceptable to ask people for whatever environmental gain, to ask people to have a plane going over their house every minute, right throughout the day. The argument is put that a minority of people, though in London, Birmingham, Gatwick and elsewhere, it's a sizable minority, presumably the argument is put that they should suffer for the wider gain. They should suffer for economic and employment reasons. I ask you to consider whether that is morally a morally tenable position. Let me just give you an example. I was speaking at a conference last year, and I wasn't actually going on about this, but I was going on about the noise. And somebody from the audience made what I think he considered to be a very valid point. He said, I'm a man in my early 60s. When I used to go away for a weekend, I used to go down to the South Coast. But now my son is able to go with his friends for his stag night to Dublin or to Prague. If you're going to manage demand or reduce demand, you're actually stopping ordinary people from doing that sort of thing. Well, you may not. But I think my argument would be, is it actually morally justified to ask a sizable number of people to suffer a plane going over their head one every 60 seconds so other people can actually go to Prague or Dublin for their stag night? I would suggest that if they were having a noisy stag night in the house next door, they would be done under the noise law for having a noisy party. If they travel to Dublin, the government applauds it. So I think there are two reasons why I would suggest the demand needs to be at very least managed, possibly reduced. One is the global climate change reasons, and secondly is the effect on local communities. Secondly, if I'm talking about managing or reducing demand, how can that be done? I believe it can be done quite simply. There's a neon light solution, which the white paper conveniently ignored. And the neon light figure is £9 billion. Because this is the tax concession which the UK aviation industry gets each year as a result of paying no tax on aviation fuel and virtually no VAT on aviation transactions. Gareth Harper is going to talk in more detail about the economics, and I'll try not to steal your speech, Gareth. But work has been done by the former Treasury economist, Brendan Sewell, and published by the Aviation Environment Federation, using the government's own model, which showed that if aviation was taxed at the same rate as petrol for cars, then there would be some growth, but the growth wouldn't be sufficient to need any more runways, even in the southeast. And that's why I say there's a neon light solution. A neon light solution which the white paper has ignored. Now, it's not easy. You will quite rightly say to me, and you will be correct, that the aviation fuel needs international agreement to be taxed. That's right, and that will be difficult. But there are substitute taxes. The European Parliament, the European Commission, even as some of you may know, is looking at a Europe-wide emissions charge. There's the raising of air passenger duty. There's noise taxes, such as are used in some of the Scandinavian countries. if the political will was there, the solution is there. And one of my great criticisms of the White Paper is not just that it rejected this solution, but it didn't even discuss it. It didn't even mention it. So the means of managing demand, in my view, if the political will is there, the means are also there. There are two main objections to this, which I'm only going to touch on because I think Gareth may talk about them in more detail. One is the equity objections. People will actually say, if fares go up, you're going to stop poor people flying. The figures actually don't indicate that. The figures show that the bottom 10% of income earners hardly fly at all right now, and because of the overall cost of the holiday, won't be flying in 30 years' time. There is a middle-income group of people who perhaps fly two or three times a year now, or could do if they so chose, who, if fares went up, would need to reduce the amount of flying they do. But very few of them would be stopped flying altogether. The main beneficiaries of the cheap fares, the main beneficiaries of the £9 billion tax concessions, are the top 10% of income earners. These are the people who are flying most. These are the people who make up virtually all the growth we're going to see over the next 30 years. What's really happened is a combination of people buying cheapish homes in France, Spain, or Italy. Before cheap flights, they found they could go maybe twice a year. But now if you can get there cheaply, of course you go for a long weekend. And that's one of the main drivers of this demand. And I would argue that if the main beneficiaries of these tax concessions are the top 10% of income earners, that's not equitable. It's a regressive tax. And I think we can say loudly and clearly that we must say loudly and clearly that that's the case. Secondly, there are employment objections. And of course, it's true that aviation assists the economy and assists employment. The figures in the White Paper are based on very shaky ground, however. They're based on a study done by the Oxford Economic Forecasting, a reputable body. But how it came about is the aviation industry wanted to do a study. They paid for this study 90% and said to the Department for Transport, would you like to commission it? The department did, published it as their study, and the contribution of aviation to the economy outlined in the White Paper is based on this study. There are many flaws in it, two in particular. One, Oxford Economic Forecasting, their brief, was told that they should not include the environmental and social costs imposed by aviation, nor should they take account of the tax concessions received by the aviation industry. And therefore, inevitably, the benefits of aviation to the economy are distinctly overplayed. And in my view, what is needed is an independent study assessing and reassessing what the true benefits of aviation are to the economy. And not looking at aviation in alone, but comparing aviation with investment in other forms of transport in other industries. What is the only study that's been done over the last couple of years has been by Professor John Whiteleg of John Moores University, who compared the investment that's predicted over the next 20, 30 years in Manchester and Liverpool universities with the with similar investment, that same money was to go into improving the surface-level public transport system within the Northwest, plus improving their rail system to London. And what Whiteleg found was that the economy of the Northwest and the jobs created would be greater if the investment, instead of going to the airports, actually went to those other things. That sort of study needs to be done on a wider basis. And only once you've got those comparisons and you're working within that framework is the government in any position to assess the true economic value of aviation to the economy. Because the White Paper did not do that, I've got to say, the economics it's come out with really don't stand up at all.
No,
Can I just say one more thing and then perhaps hand over to Gareth? The one other positive thing I was going to mention on demand management is investment in the rail system. I know there's big debates about high-speed rail and how environmentally friendly it may or may not be. But this will be a positive way of curbing growth in aviation. 45% of all the journeys we make in the Euro-controlled countries, that's the wider Europe, are 500 kilometres or less in length. That's about a three-hour train journey. The Germans, the French, the Dutch are investing in those trains. It's hardly been looked at in the run-up to the aviation white paper, and again, work needs to be done at that. Just before I hand over to Gareth, I think my concluding remark would be that it is perfectly possible to manage demand, it's perfectly possible to reduce demand without the economy suffering, without employment suffering, and I would argue that given the environmental and social downsides of the aviation industry, there's a moral imperative to do so.
Thank you very much. Gareth, you're going to pick up now on whether the economics are true. Do you want this
mic? Back to this one's not working, is it?
I don't think so.
Can you hear me? This is actually working.
Okay.
That's coming through clearly. Good. The trouble is I'm a bit of a mobile speaker, so you might hear the first part of the sentence, but not necessarily the end. Chairman, thank you for the introduction. Thank you also to London School of Economics for the opportunity to give this talk this evening. I'm no more than an enthusiastic amateur in this area. My interest really comes from the fact that I moved out of the Twickenham area nearly 20 years ago at a time when there was a public inquiry into building a fourth terminal at Heathrow. I sort of listened to the economic arguments. They didn't seem to me to be particularly persuasive, but I didn't really delve into them in any great depth since I was moving out of the area. Well, I moved back to Twickenham some 10 years later, only to find that they were now proposing to build a fifth terminal. Moreover, the economic arguments that were being brought out by the government seemed to have been remarkably similar to the ones they were saying 10 years ago. And with the passage of time, they didn't seem to have acquired any greater authority or conviction. So there we are. Now I can move about. I've got a very short period of 15 minutes in which really there's quite a lot to try to get across in with some sense of conviction. I'll perhaps try to divide things between talking first of all those economic arguments that the government is prepared to bandy around. And secondly, those economic arguments, and John has touched on them essentially with the tax issue, that it doesn't like to talk about. If we take then the economic and social arguments that the government parades in order to justify more runway expansion, they can basically be broken down into four headings. Firstly, it's to enable UK businesses to compete for import and export opportunities in a global market. Secondly, it's to attract more inward investment to the UK. Thirdly, it's to attract more overseas tourists to the UK. And finally, which is perhaps less of an economic and more of a social issue, to enable more UK tourists to fly overseas. Well, if we go back to the first argument about international business, of course, no one would deny that we're in a global economy. But I mean, the language that the department used, you would really think that we were in the age of Marco Polo, this concept that people actually physically had to move across the globe in vast numbers. I mean, the facts of the matter are that currently less than 20% of air passengers using UK airports are in fact on business journeys. The vast majority, 80%, are in fact engaged on non-business activities, and the long-term trend has shown the a decline in the percentage of businessmen travelling as a total percentage. Now, the Department for Transport, really on the basis that people have limited opportunities for holidays, therefore produce projections which will show that the increase in non-business passengers will decline, and that there will be a corresponding increase in the number of business passengers. However, that's to simply to ignore the fact that the phenomenon with non-business passengers essentially is the frequent flying during the year, the arrival of the weekend break in Prague. But even under the department's own forecasts, down to the year 2020, which is the only year that they've given us projections by passenger category, even under those projections, no more than 30% of passengers using UK airports would be businessmen. So it is simply not the case to say that if no more runway provision were provided, that somehow UK business would be frozen out of the global economy. Of course, there would inevitably be congestion at airports, but the department has identified £100 fare premium as the level that, as it were, would match excess demand over supply. They don't explain the basis of the £100, but I presume that's where the additional pricing would start to sort of cut out those who would not pay. Now, you know, as we all know, businessmen already pay through the nose. Business passengers pay significantly more than non-business passengers. So if it came to a bidding match, you can quite clearly take it as read that the businessman would always get the spare seat on the plane, because ultimately he is engaged in economic activity. He judges that he will recover the costs of travel by the business that the travelling will engender, whereas a non-business passenger is basically having to pay out of their own pockets and essentially for leisure purposes, and therefore the Department for Transport correctly identifies them as being far more susceptible to price changes and price increases. If we then move on to the argument about the inward investment, well, this is an example, if you like, of the department going in for double counting, because of course inward investment can only be attracted to the UK by businessmen. It's not the non-business passenger that's flying, and we've already identified that in fact the size of the number of business passengers is simply not the driving factor in the need for more runways. As to the case for attracting more overseas tourists to the UK, one of the things that the department has reluctant to acknowledge is the colossal trade deficit that the UK runs on tourism. I think that the figure last year reached 15 billion, a deficit of 15 billion. That's the imbalance between the consumer goods and services that overseas visitors purchase in the UK compared with the consumer goods and services that UK visitors purchase overseas. Not only is that, as it were, a loss of 15 billion purchasing power to the UK economy, there is, in addition, the fact that these goods and services all attract VAT, and so there's something like a 2 billion loss to the Treasury as well from that imbalance. So it's no wonder that the government wishes to attract more tourists to offset that situation. The problem is that, again, the long-term trend shows a widening gap between the number of people coming to the UK compared with the number of people visiting overseas. And although, again, the department forecasts that by the year 2020 that trend would reverse, and they offer no reason as to why it should be, other than I guess it's going to change at some time, even so, the deficit is even wider. That's to say, the imbalance between the actual numbers of visitors to the UK as compared with the number of visitors overseas. So if we then move on to the sort of the quasi-social reason, which is simply to enable more UK tourists to fly overseas, this is dressed up in sort of egalitarian terms. But as John Stewart has already indicated, the fact of the matter is that at the moment, less than 50% of the population flies overseas for leisure. And under the government's forecasts, That figure would not significantly change over the next 20 years. The simple fact of the matter is that with air prices at an all-time low, the actual price of a ticket, say, to Paris is virtually within everyone's reach. The reason why half the population doesn't go to Paris is because of the costs of the hotels, the food, and the other incidentals that dwarf the total dwarf the cost of a holiday. So the egalitarian argument simply does not stack up. The point about the tourist industry, the UK tourist industry, is that with the low prices, it clearly is now a very good consumer purchase, and one's not having any sort of sense of Calvinistic condemnation if people see that that's a good deal. But the fact of the matter is that level of demand is either stimulated by or is suppressed by the tax treatment of the airlines. And here we move into the field of debate that the government is simply unwilling to have. John Stewart mentioned the fact that currently airlines are exempt from fuel duty and they're also exempt from VAT. The total cost per year of that exemption is estimated to be in the region of £9 billion. Now, it'll obviously vary from year to year depending on the number of passengers, but clearly if you're predicting a tripling of passengers compared with today and in 30 years' time, you're talking about a tripling of the value of those tax exemptions from £9 billion a year to £27 billion a year. Now, there are two reasons why these tax exemptions are applied. Firstly, the practical legal question, which is that under a convention signed in 1944, when the industry was in its infancy, there is an international agreement that airlines will not be taxed on fuel. There are also, under EC rules on VAT, an agreement that services, goods and services that go beyond EC borders shall not be subject to VAT. But within both those constraints, there is still the opportunity for countries to tax internal flights, but both for fuel. And there are a number of countries, including the United States and Sweden, that do that. There is also the opportunity for governments to apply VAT to flights that are within European destinations. So there are the means available to government to claw back at least some of the tax that it misses. But this government has traditionally and consistently decided not to do so. I have to say there was a valid attempt by Kenneth Clark under the last Conservative government to tackle this problem. We had a situation with national finances, a large deficit facing the Treasury, and they were reluctant to go to the same taxpayers. So he introduced something called air passenger duty. And the terms in which he introduced this made it clear that he saw this as a surrogate tax for the fact that the airlines were exempt from fuel duty and from VAT. And of course, the way that air passenger duty operates, it's not incidentally charged on passengers, it's charged on airlines, on the number of passengers that they have on board when the flight departs. It applies equally to overseas airlines using UK airports as much as to UK airlines using airports. So there is no discrimination between national carriers and overseas carriers, and there is certainly nothing under international law to prevent air passenger duty being A, set, and B, set at whatever level the national government chooses to do so. At the moment, air passenger duty brings in less than £1 billion a year to the revenue. So if you set against that the value of the fuel duty and VAT exemptions of £9 billion, you're talking about the industry being well off to the tune of £8 billion per year. Now, no one likes to pay taxes, but on the other hand, we all recognise that there are state services that we want and we need. And there is questions, for example, I'm going to be flagrantly populist here, about funding higher education. It seems to me a precarious set of values of the New Labour that they are perfectly prepared to continue to apply tax exemptions that benefit the top half of the population so that they can fly as and when they want, but they're not prepared to invest taxpayers' money in funding a skilled workforce, as the government now tends to see university education in terms of. But there's a more serious point as well, that clearly if you exempt one particular sector of the economy from taxes, then other sectors of the economy pay disproportionately more taxes. And again, I'm afraid to be vulgar, the value of £8 billion is equivalent to every taxpayer paying £352 a year. So it seems to me that there is a potential gain-gain situation for politicians here. Those that are looking to increase public income could do so through air passenger duty. Conversely, those who argue that they would like to reduce the tax burden, particularly the income tax burden, well, here is a sitting target. Now, the government has always sought, in promoting aviation expansion, to present it as a stark contrast between economic needs for the nation as a whole and the somewhat selfish interests of those directly affected adversely. I hope I've shown that the economic arguments that the government uses are, in fact, not as substantial as they claim. And I hope I further drawn to your attention the scale of the tax exemptions for this industry. And as John Stewart has already indicated, the Department for Transport's own passenger model showed that if the $8 billion were loaded onto airlines, then the level of demand for air passengers over the next 30 years would drop significantly to a sufficient level that there would be no case for building additional runways. And it really is, for those of us that are going to carry on with this battle, it really is a lesson that we must not simply concentrate on the negative environmental downsides, serious though they are. We must also carry forward challenges at every stage to the economic benefits that are claimed for aviation. Thank you.
Thanks. First, I'd like to apologise for my coughing and spluttering, but when someone asks me to speak about the European Investment Bank, I find it hard to refuse. So, but I'm not going to speak for long. My name's Hannah Ellis. I work for Friends of the Earth International, based here in London, and I campaign on international finance institutions, particularly the European Investment Bank. And I'm just going to give you a quick overview as to the EIB lending in the aviation sector. So just in the next 5 minutes, I'll give you a brief introduction to the European Investment Bank, the EIB's involvement in the aviation industry. I'll just briefly go over our report. I've got a copy just here, which is also on the side there. Thanks. And please pick up a copy, Flying with Big Business, and talk a bit about what's in it. So the EIB, they were founded in 1958 as part of the European Union with the aim of funding social and economic cohesion of the member states to redevelop Europe after the Second World War, particularly in terms of infrastructure, road building and transport. They're supported by 150 billion euros of subscribed capital. That's about 100 billion pounds by the member states. So that's including the UK. Each of the member states of the EU put in this backed money to the European Investment Bank, which they then invest in bonds and shares and provide virtually interest-free loans for projects in the interest of the European Union. So they signed almost 40 billion euros last year, mostly for infrastructure projects. They have a broad definition by the EU for social and economic cohesion, and five target areas, including infrastructure, research and development of the union, environmental development. But basically, any project, as long as it doesn't break national law, can be funded. I'll go into more details as to why I'm making such an accusation in, later. So in terms of the aviation sector, in the last 5 years approximately, we had 7.8 billion euros of virtually interest-free loans of taxpayers' money in Europe going into the aviation sector thanks to the European Investment Bank. Now, we were quite curious as to these figures at Friends of the Earth, why someone like the EIB would be financing this type of investment. The EIB seemed to finance a wide range of things, from the somewhat bizarre providing loans for IKEA stores in Germany to extremely controversial environmental and socially irresponsible projects like the Chad Cameroon oil pipeline. So there's a coalition of environmental and social groups known as the EIB Campaign Coalition with the motto "Public Money for Public Good." And this group noted that the EIB were incredibly involved in aviation expansion. And so we put together with Central and Eastern European Bankwatch Network, Friends of the Earth Netherlands, Milieu Defensi, Zazimeter in Bulgaria, and John here from Haycan Clear Skies, to go into a bit more detail to see what we could find about the EIB's involvement in aviation. So we found that 8 billion euros were invested in aviation in the last 5 years. That this contradicts the EIB's own climate and sustainable development policies. They have, if you go to the EIB's website, www.eib.org, you'll find policies on climate change and sustainable development, saying that the EIB may not and will not fund any project which breaches sustainable development guidelines set out by the EU, and that they promote projects which would reduce and are minimal impacts to climate. Aviation is the fastest growing source of climate change emissions in the world today. Now, an interesting finding of the report was also that these loans often go to big businesses, which actually violates the EIB's own statute. The EIB, under its statute given to it by the European Commission, are only allowed to fund loans to companies when funds are not available from other sources on reasonable terms, therefore improving the social and economic cohesion of the union and not giving taxpayers money to projects which would be financed anyway. So BAA, which is in the FTSE 100 and is an extremely wealthy company, actually told me personally, the head of their treasury department, that the reason why the EIB provided them with a loan was because they have a long-standing relationship with the European Investment Bank. That they could have got the money from other sources, but the EIB provides them with a relatively cheap source of funds. This, I would have thought, is also the case with Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, which is an extremely controversial project. In fact, I was visiting some of my colleagues in Amsterdam last week, and they showed me an article, which unfortunately I couldn't understand because it was in Dutch, in one of their national papers last week. And due to our report, they were reporting that now Friends of the Earth Netherlands are considering taking the European Investment Bank to the European Court of Justice. But this was, in that case, it was actually based on the fact that the EIB had agreed to provide the loan before the environmental and social impact assessments had been carried out. So another thing that EIB do, this European institution, is that they take no responsibility for the assessment or the impact on the environment or the communities of this investment on those projects. That's all up to the project promoter, the person they're lending the money to. In the environmental impact assessments carried out, as I mentioned previously, Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, the loan from the EIB was agreed before the environmental impact assessment was carried out. Sofia Airport in Bulgaria, a thorough environmental impact assessment has never been carried out. The EIB argue, when you ask them, why is this EU institution with taxpayers' money providing interest-free loans for these very profitable businesses and aviation expansion, which often leads to environmental and social degradation? They argue that this is promoting competitive advantage for these airports. But this, I have a problem with this argument as to how they can possibly fund competitive advantage when they're providing loans for several of these hub airports within the European Union, providing competitive advantage for Heathrow, while also providing loans for Schiphol and Frankfurt airports. So just to summarise quickly, the EIB are huge financial contributors to the European aviation industry. Their involvement in this area, as in most areas, they're often referred to as the ghost bank, is not well known, and that they take virtually no social or environmental responsibility for this investment. Just to give you a quick comparison to the World Bank, the EIB gives 40 billion loans every year. The World Bank, I think last year, was 32. The World Bank has thousands of staff, a team of 300 environmental experts. The European Investment Bank has 1,000 staff and two environmental experts based in Luxembourg. So myself and other members of the EIB campaign coalition are very concerned as to how this bank are lending and their project portfolios in all aspects within the European Union, but also in the Global South. And particularly, I'm finding it quite interesting, this involvement in the aviation industry. Thank you. That's it.
Well, in a short time this evening, we seem to have travelled from realising that the figures that are there can be disputed, that there are things that are being ignored about this market, and there are some scandals also coming through. This is a pretty ropey view of what is a very important part of industry and of our lives. In the audience, please make statements if you want to, or ask questions, but in both cases, please be as brief as you can. Who would be the first? Right, thank you. Could you sort of stand up, because so the people behind you as well.
Hi, good evening. Claudio Calcagno from the school. As a student, I completely agree with the tax concessions being a big distortion. How about the scarcity rents given through grandfathering? I'm referring to the slots.
Sorry, say that again, the what?
The scarcity rents, the economic rents that are given for free to the airlines because they do not have to pay for the slots. How about auctioning them instead of grandfathering? And would that be politically viable?
I think a number of organisations, including the think tank IPPR, are very keen on slot auctioning. There are a number of ways in which that could be done. It could be done like the mobile phone auctioning was done. That would bring the exchequer quite a lot of money. The money equally could be go back into the industry on condition that they use that for environmental improvements. But certainly it's feasible. And I would have thought that with a little bit of political bravery, it's doable as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I really can't believe that serious discussion is taking place in this august hall on an issue which is so cut and dried. There is no doubt that climate scientists have unanimously or near unanimously agreed that the issue of greenhouse gas emissions poses the most serious threat to the future of the planet that air travel is one of the main contributors insofar as it is an activity which John Stewart referred to, which is growing at an alarming rate, where the greenhouse gases are released in the upper atmosphere. That we hear from Peter Mackenzie Williams that the forecast growth in this activity is to carry on. Do we live in the madhouse where we, so to speak, sit politely and listen to talk about the growth of this industry, which is destroying the planet, making its unfair contribution to this, simply because we don't know how to cope with it? Well, there is a simple way of coping with it, which is, of course, the only way of doing it, which some of you may be familiar with from the Global Commons Institute, the principle of contraction and convergence, which inevitably leads to carbon rationing. Within the carbon ration, there can be no future for air travel, simply because we have got to globally cut down on greenhouse gas emissions by 60% on an equity base, which is on both moral and political grounds the only base on which we're going to reach international agreement. That means for us in the UK and Western Europe a reduction of 90%. How anybody can seriously talk about a future in which air travel is to thrive rather than to decline very sharply and soon is flying in the face of the sort of reason which must inform politicians, and urgently.
Thank you very much. Over here.
Thank you. BAA and British Airports Authority, British Airways and BAA, have somewhat surprisingly come out in support of the aviation industry joining the emissions trading scheme at some stage from, say, 2008. Does the panel consider this to be a viable option, or is it more of a stalling tactic?
Who wants to talk?
Well, John may offer his own gloss, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that they've been talking about emission trading for a number of years. I would tend to view, you know, if we came back in 10 years' time, they'd still be talking about emission trading. I mean, quite apart from anything else, as the previous speaker indicated, we're talking about implications even for global warming here. The consultation document speaks about the need to ensure that industry pays its cost. I mean, how do you cost global warming? It's also a rather interesting approach. I mean, do we let the mafia operate as long as they pay for their social costs? I mean, it's just a bizarre approach to things.
Well, yes, well, I was as well just interested in, about the emissions trading approach as an alternative solution if the government... If the government isn't willing to introduce plant taxation. So are there any other economic instruments that you would consider possible option? Because I was listening to this talk and didn't hear any solutions to reducing demand or controlling demand. Thank you.
Yes. I don't think so. I think I spoke too quickly. And too much. Yes, there are alternatives. There's the emissions charge. Some of the European politicians are looking at an EU emissions charge, and that would be a charge on aeroplanes landing or taking off at European airports according to how much emissions they produce. Now, clearly, that wouldn't reach planes that don't touch Europe, but it would affect a lot of planes from all countries. So that is an alternative to emissions trading. There is simply putting up air passenger duty as well. So I think there are solutions. I think many of us are quite skeptical about the emissions trading because the detail is not there. And I think the general feeling is the industry at the moment feels that emissions trading would cost them less than an emissions charge, and maybe that's one of the reasons why they're pushing for it.
Thank you. My name is Terry McGrenner. I'm a member of the Green Party, which was inadvertently left off the group of people who are against the sort of the airport expansion. And be that as may. Thank you. Over Christmas, actually, I picked up Lester Brown's book, actually. I've forgotten the title, actually. it was the Economy or something. And one of the things he sort of laid out in his book was basically that up until now, what we have done is we've let the economy rule over the environment. And the way to solve the problem as regards the future, and as what this gentleman referred to, is from now on, basically, the environment has to decide the economic activity. As I say, up until now, that's been the reverse. So in a sense, I mean, sir, it says here in your leaflet, it's the economy, stupid. So now it's the environment, stupid. So as I say, I am a member of the Green Party, and I'm in the process of putting together the manifesto for the GLA elections in June, and the European elections also taking place on the same day. And aviation industry will form a major part of our policies. And just to finish off, actually, I would just like to, if somebody would mention the Ryanair Dodge, which has been worked in Europe, actually, and how they do it as regarding the money, which they is our money, which is going to a regional department, and then sort of they are giving by way of a backhander to Ryanair. If somebody could mention that, I'd be obliged. Thank you for your help.
Does anyone want to comment on that?
Okay. Well, I have to say I've got a bit of a soft spot for O'Leary, because I mean, he is upsetting what's effectively, I mean, it's still essentially quasi-monopoly situation in the airlines. And I just like the way O'Leary's upset the others. And he says, you know, there's nothing difficult about running an airway. We just fly people around. It's a good and service like anything else. And I like it that he's destroying the mystique that surrounds the airlines, that somehow it's something extra special. It's just a typical trading sector in goods and services. I quite agree with your point about the environment ought to start to tell the economy more what to do. But I would argue that we've not actually got a genuine sort of economic solution here, because you're talking about massive tax exemptions from general revenue purposes, quite apart from environmental damage, from general revenue points of view. Now, you know, who do you tax if you don't tax dynamic sectors of the economy? I think that's where the government is getting its... he's coming up with a deceptive argument. It is not about the economy versus the environment. It's about one particular sector, the air transport sector, that's got a department, rather in the way that the agricultural lobby had MAF, batting for it, ensuring that it's got all sorts of vested interests that are well protected.
Peter, do you want to comment on that?
Only to maybe add a little bit of detail on the Charleroi case, which I think is probably the main case that you're referring to, where the local Chamber of Commerce reached an agreement with Ryanair on an exclusive basis to provide them with financial encouragement to serve their airport. That case was taken by a competitor airline to the European courts, and the decision is expected this week, and it's widely been leaked that the arrangement will have to end, and that will have implications for a number of other Ryanair services and possibly services by other airlines throughout Europe. It's simply a case that the state aids rules were contravened in that case.
Could the speakers please tell us something about the scale, their views on the scale? Could the speakers tell us something about the scale and adequacy of the record of the harmful effects of the emissions from aircraft landing and taking off? I recall about 10 years ago that I think in the States, in the San Francisco, Californian area, some interesting work was done on the aerosols which were released by aircraft landing and taking off, and the injurious effect they had on the health of populations in the locality. It seems that we are so preoccupied with noise, understandably, it's something we can all appreciate, that the harmful effects, the effects causing asthma and other lung and inhalation ailments are rather neglected by comparison.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think there is something of a sea change, though, as regards recognition of, in the white paper, as regards the recognition of the impact of emissions. The particular problem for the Heathrow development is that already the levels of nitrogen dioxide around the nitrogen dioxide around the airport exceed EC limit values, and would even more exceed them if there's further development there. Those EC limit values kick in; they have to member states have to comply with them after 2009. And they're under an obligation now to put in place action plans to ensure that there is no exceedance by the year 2010. So, you know, there is now recognition, I think, of the impacts of air pollutants, I admit, but not all of them. But ultimately, I mean, it is ironic that quite clearly the government has been scared off by the EC obligations rather than necessarily the science. And I have very little doubt that if these were entirely UK-set standards, then the government would have found some means of giving an exemption to enable an additional third runway to be built.
Okay. The answer that Mr. Darling gave on the fuel tax point was that air transport is a form of public transport, and the other forms of public transport don't pay very much in the way of fuel tax or VAT. The other slight difference I have is over the viability of railways now that we've got to the stage of low-cost airlines. The low-cost airlines, which have been running much longer in the States, have really massacred long-haul rail transport. And the Deputy Secretary of Transportation told us that we believe long-haul railroad passenger transportation is no longer viable. We're looking at 17.5 pence per passenger kilometre on the West Coast Main Line, only 9 on the East Coast, but that's coming up for renewal very quickly. There's a subsidy of 6.5. Ryanair's cost is 4.2 pence per passenger kilometre, and railway trains have to travel far further than aeroplanes, 401.5 miles from Euston to Glasgow, 345 from Heathrow to Glasgow, 325 from Luton. 60% Luton-Glasgow is business, 78% of Heathrow-Newcastle is business. So I think there's a good case. And finally, the Japanese have built up 120 billion of non-performing railway debt, and the Japanese railwayman told me recently, we are sitting on a volcano.
I think we should have to have you on the platform next time. It was very interesting. Yes. Oh yes, just a moment. One comment first.
I thought your figures were very interesting, but I'd just like to make a point about this discussion of fiscal analysis of the aviation industry. As myself and some of the speakers have been discussing, these fiscal studies which have been carried out, which the aviation industry is basing itself on in its future growth, are not considering the environmental and social implications of aviation expansion. They're not considering climate change. They're not considering health issues. They're not considering the damage to the people who live in the close areas and in the world that these projects involve. And this, I think, is what we're trying to get out here, is that not only should the aviation industry be aware in terms of its development to ensure that it's sustainable in an economic setting, but that the environmental and social implications of this industry need to be taken into account on any investigation of its economic viability.
Thank you. We talked about demand management, and obviously that's one key issue, but also a lot of people talk about sustainable development, and one of the key principles of sustainable development is not that you stop growth, but that you decouple growth from things such as environmental problems. So in terms of aviation, it seems that the way you would do this is through technology, and technology was touched on very, very briefly, and I think it might be John mentioned that really technology has gone as far as it's going to go. I was just wondering what the options are, because that seems to me the only way we can really enshrine sustainable development principles without saying no one can fly anywhere.
Yeah, a little bit on the technology. I think there are two problems. I mean, but I think the main one is regulation. At the moment, there is no real incentive for the aviation industry to invest in cleaner and quieter technology. We're beginning to get a little bit with the EU directive on the legal limits on air pollution. But it does seem to me that we need to have certainly European-wide regulation, limits, saying to the aviation industry, if you want to grow, and I know there's a debate about that, but if you want to grow, if you want to have more planes, you've got to be able to reduce your noise and air pollution and emissions limits by X amount, and given a timescale. And I think that's the key thing, because once the industry, and it applies to the whole industry, once they've got that regulation in place, then I think there's a momentum to develop a new technology. Without that, there's a real problem. Many of the industry say right now that they do believe that the technology may be there to develop cleaner planes rather more quickly than quieter planes. But I think I would like to see what they had to say once the regulations were in place.
Thanks. John Gordon, trustee for the London region of CPRE, which has also been very much involved. My question is mainly to Gareth and John. You and others all have put forward extremely cogent arguments, as well as my friend Maya Hillman next door, why what is proposed is batty from the local, national and global angle. The fact remains that it's government policy. They are supported by millions of people who would like to fly cheaply and don't think through the longer-term consequences. I suspect people in this hall, sadly, are a very small and well-educated minority. And in a way, it may just go to sleep until the planning applications go in for building things, which seems a long way away. So my question to you, and it's very sympathetically posed, what is your strategy of public engagement? How do we get this into the national debate? Labour don't want to know, Tories don't want to know, Lib Dems pretty feeble about it, Green Party's great, but it's not counting for much. What should we all be doing about it?
I think you're absolutely right. One of the main reasons why the government hasn't tackled this is fear of being seen by the newspapers and by the general public as stopping people flying, and they're aware, obviously, of the popularity. I think we've got to come at this from a different angle, and Gareth touched upon it in his talk. I think government has got to take the lead in spelling out to people not just the environmental consequences, but perhaps, being self-interested human beings, how the subsidies and the tax concessions for industry are hitting their pockets. The sort of taxes, as Gareth said, that the average person is paying income tax each year to deal with those tax concessions. I agree very much, John, that it's a long-term process, but I think the government has got to start off that debate and start from that side of things. And then I believe there's a chance of taking the public with us.
Yes, the proposed expansion at Heathrow. Can you give me an indication, a feeling for whether this is for the benefit of travellers who are Londoners, or whether it's for the benefit of transit passengers?
Currently, approximately a third of passengers passing through Heathrow are transferring from one flight to another, so you can rule those out as Londoners. Off the top of my head, I would say that something like 40% of Heathrow passengers are from, if not Greater London, then certainly the South East. The remainder will be drawn from the home counties. You've still got something like 10% of Heathrow passengers being drawn down from the north of England, simply because Heathrow has a critical mass of services which would never be viable from other airports. So you're only ever going to have demand within the UK or within Great Britain for services to certain points in the world, say Bangkok, for example. It's unlikely that you'd ever be able to operate viably from Bangkok to Glasgow, shall we say, and probably not to Manchester either. So there are always going to be flights out of the major international hub at Heathrow, which will draw passengers down from elsewhere.
Peter, isn't it true that London
that's a good one. Well, certainly Paris, obviously Charles de Gaulle is a good way north of the city. Frankfurt is quite a way out. Amsterdam, there is a certain amount of overflying problem. I mean, those are the main four. Heathrow is probably the worst, yeah. I would say, yes.
I mean, in a sense, it seems strange that we have an institution which are saying the easy thing is to close down Heathrow.
Well, that was, of course, proposed in the 60s, and we touched on this earlier. And if Great Britain had been prepared to grasp the nettle in the 60s in the same way that the French did, by taking a futuristic view and building Charles de Gaulle, if we had then, at that time, built at Maplin, then maybe things would be very different today. But I've long held the view that the only way to make a new airport proposal to the east of London work will be to close down Heathrow, and probably Gatwick also.
A second bite of the cherry, if I may, insofar as this subject that I raised hasn't properly been taken up. Let me tell you that a round flight from London to New York produces between 2 and 3 times the carbon dioxide emission equivalents that each person presently living on the planet could be allowed on an equity base. If you exceed your fare ration, if it were distributed fairly, then there can be only 2 outcomes. Either you have got to deny those people who aren't yet accessing their fare ration, mainly people living in the developing world, from having their ration. You've got to do that forcibly because they're coming up fast behind us. Or you have to face up to the harsh realization that you are wittingly, you personally are wittingly contributing to the devastation of the planet. These are the harsh realities that are being evaded because people don't want to face unpalatable truths. We are all locked into this process and we've got to get off it soon.
My name is Richard Wilson. I work for an organisation called The Environment. I should stand up as well, okay. So I just have to respond to that unpalatable truth. I'm just speaking very much as a person, not a representative, as an organisation. I'm bought into the argument that we have to stop flying. But for as long as we have these cheap flights down to Marseille for £16, I don't have the strength of will to not afford that. I really don't. I love the south of France. I'm going to keep going there. But I really believe in it, and I've devoted my life to environmental protection. And so I'm bought into your arguments for using the economic case, because clearly that's the only way you're going to be able to have those kind of price incentives. But I think also, building upon the point that was made before, unless you make it real politics, unless you see this as a vote winner, then no one's ever going to come up. Because if people like me don't believe in it, no one else is going to believe in it. And I think also within that context, I'd like to also sort of grab the nettle of the fact that we have social lock-in, whereby people in this country have got families and friends who live across the world. And how we tackle that within the sort of real political framework, I think is an incredible challenge, and I'd like to hear what you think.
This is an echo of the old Echo Warriors problem about wanting to solve problems, and the only way you can do it quickly is by flying all over the place.
Can I just emphasize that I can serve George Monbiot in his archive to commemoration of the Orville Wright sort of flight on the 17th of December 1903 was to write an article in The Guardian saying, I mean, sort of, that the planes were wings of death, and sort of a letter in The Guardian actually sort of a few days later saying, if you look at his website, he's on a 30 sort of nation tour, and he posed the question, how does he think he's going to get there, you know? So,
yeah.
I'm
going to keep it in the audience.
I'm Stephen Ulig. I'm an economic consultant on airports. I have 2 points. The first one is this tax thing is important, but I think even if passengers were to bear this 8 billion gap, what is it? It's 20, 30, 40 squid per departing passenger. I don't think you're going to squeeze out that much demand. I think the demand is always going to be there. I think the challenge is to put airports in the right place. Putting them in the right place, surely for London, with an 80% prevailing westerly or southwesterly wind, has to be a Thameside airport. combining the expansion between Stansted and Heathrow seems to me the absolute worst of all worlds. It is going to enhance the burden on the environment because it is going to reduce precisely what the airlines want, the opportunities for connectivity between flights. It means, in fact, you're going to be using smaller aircraft, whereas one of the benefits of improved technology should be the ability to utilize larger aircraft, fewer aircraft and larger aircraft. Dispersing your demand across two points of departure is going to reduce that opportunity.
Peter Moore, East End teacher here. I've stopped my father from flying, actually, at the age of 86, or 85. I want to have him near an airport. And the reason is I'm worried about all the queues and that. I think it's a very stressful environment indeed. And I think something needs to be looked at, the stress involved at airports. And there are other factors as well, of course, the slots and the stress on the pilots as well. And they've got a 20-minute turnaround on Ryanair as well, as you probably know. So that's my point. Stress, particularly for elderly people at airports, I think is tremendous. The queuing, etc.
I often wonder that small airports are the nice ones, like London City Airport, you know, or Denver. Is there a solution of having lots of small airports instead of these giant ones, which get more and more horrible, as you say, and more unnerving all the time? Is there any way of going, way of going that way? Which is, who want to ask?
I think Peter's going.
Well. Nice idea, but I don't think so. It comes back to the point you just made. Greater efficiency comes from larger aeroplanes. The larger the aeroplanes, the larger the airports. And I think that's the end of the idea. But you're quite right, London City is a nice place to fly out of.
If you only think of efficiency in economic terms, you think of it from the airline's point of view. If you think of it from the passenger's point of view, it could be much.
If you think of it from the passenger's point of view, it would be more attractive. I think, not that I know the first thing about the environmental arguments, but I would have thought you'd end up with far more pollutants if you've got lots of small aircraft flying around than a smaller number of larger ones.
Someone should look into it.
Indeed.
Hello.
Hi, I just have a comment about decreasing flights and so on. I'm from Canada. The province I'm from, Ontario, is bigger than Europe, I think, and it's just not an option for us to hop in our car on a train and go out to visit grandma, you know, out west or something, because first of all, the demand isn't there to support a proper railway system. So if you could address maybe challenges that outside of Europe, it's possible here, but maybe not everywhere.
But with special permits, grandma.
Just very quickly, I think if we start reducing, we don't start on long distance journeys in Canada. I think the point really is we can start very viably, particularly if there are good alternatives, in short haul flights. And I was saying within Europe, 45% of trips are less than 500 kilometres in length. And I think we start where it's more feasible. It's the same really if you're trying to reduce the amount of traffic on the roads. You start with the shorter journeys where there are viable alternatives of walking, cycling, or buses. And I think the same principle can be applied to the railways. So you're safe for a while yet to fly to see your grandma.
I was just going to say, with regard to the climate change, it's not just the actual... It's not just the greenhouse emissions, like carbon dioxide, but it's the vapour trails that they produce. Read an interesting article saying that on September 11, when after all the aircraft were grounded, the temperature dropped by about 1.2 degrees or something like that. So, I mean, it's not just the carbon dioxide, but it's the climate change from the cloud that they effectively make. I was just going to ask, just leading on from that, considering that vapour trails and that are the problem, isn't it maybe the best thing to do is to try and get people to fly on the bigger planes, like this new Airbus that's flying instead of lots of sort of medium-bodied 777s or A340s, etc., which hold only about 250 passengers instead of 500. But, I mean, that goes against what people want. They want to fly more frequently, more often, etc. Any ideas about that?
Anybody want to
I think, again, it comes down to passenger choice and airlines' interpretation of passenger choice. After the 747 was introduced, it was the staple of transatlantic flights. And after twin-engined aircraft were certificated to fly long-haul, gradually the 747s were phased out, and smaller aircraft, 767s initially, and now the 777, were brought in precisely because passengers cared more about the frequency, the flexibility they had from the choice of four or five flights a day as compared to maybe two or three flights a day in 747s. So it's it really does come back to educating the passenger.
Focuses on this issue, and although we all came here, I think because we realise it's an important one, I think we've been given a lot more information and ammunition and a lot more reason to actually tell other people that we should be focusing on this issue much more closely than we are, and let's get our facts right, as you say, for a change. So I'd like to ask you to thank the four speakers, and also Henry Thoresby, who in fact is sitting just in the front here, who organized it all, and both of you. And thank you very, very much. And thank you for being such a very, very good audience. Thank you.